are traditionalist conservatives. Conservatives are in the best position to maintain and defend and hand down the great tradition of religious freedom. We are in the best position to do it because we care more than anybody else about the tradition of religious freedom. What is that tradition? That's what we're going to talk about today. But that's my main admonition, it's my main argument for you today. That conservatives, us, we're the ones that care the most about this, and we're the ones that are going to be the best at defending and maintaining and handing it down to our children. All right, let's start off with a story. This is a picture of Judge Kyle Duncan. Judge Duncan is the U.S. Circuit Judge on the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Fifth Circuit. He's a conservative. And this is a photograph of him as he was giving a lecture in a classroom at Stanford Law School on March the 9th, 2023. Judge Duncan was invited to by the Stanford chapter of the Federalist Society to speak to the law school students on the role of the circuit. While he was speaking, and in fact this picture was taken in the middle of his talk, protesters came to shut the event down because Judge Duncan ruled against a convicted child pornographer who wanted to be addressed by his preferred pronouns in prison. In his case, female. In 2020, Norman Varner was sentenced to 10 and a half years in jail and 15 years of supervised release. While he was in prison, he changed his name to Catherine Nicole Jett and demanded that the court refer to him as a female. And Judge Duncan rejected his demand. Praise the Lord for that. But protesters mobbed the classroom. They insulted Judge Duncan. They interrupted him every third word. One even said that they hoped his daughters were raped. When Duncan asked for an administrator to step in and deal with the crowd, the person that the university sent was the DEI officer who came in and gave a 6-minute lecture to the judge about his need to learn from the protesters and to disabuse himself of his white privilege. Ultimately, Duncan had to be escorted off campus by U.S. Marshals. And stories like this are very common these days. Here's another one. 2017, the conservative scholar Charles Murray was shouted down while he was giving a talk at Middlebury College in Vermont. Students chanted, "Racist, sexist, anti-gay, Charles Murray, go away." Real smart, right? Real sophisticated. They also stood up and they turned their backs on him while he spoke. They stomped their feet while he was speaking. And they mobbed the podium. This is a picture from the event. The professor who invited Charles Murray to speak, her name was Allison Stranger. She was assaulted by a student as they were leaving the classroom and getting in a car to leave. A mob surrounded the car, beating the sides and bouncing it up and down as they were departing. She was grabbed by the hair, twisted her neck, and received a concussion. And she was treated. Now, these examples show that the hard left is intent on undermining and destroying any kind of dissent to their godless ideology and are willing to employ revolutionary tactics to do so. What is their agenda on the left? Eradication of the Electoral College, reality to suit their individual subjective concepts of truth. You know, when they say, my truth, your truth. And these concepts of truth are based on experience and feelings. Your experience, your feelings are the sole test for truth. And intimidation, violence, censorship, all of these things are un-American. Now, all of us in this gathering can agree that the situation presented to us by the left is critical. The reason why it's critical is because it's revolutionary. It's radical. Now, among us in this room, there will probably be essential points of disagreement that we have as to how to address the situation that the left presents us with. Some of us, like yours truly, will say that the answer is to champion American constitutionalism. That's one part of the answer. Others of you may say, no, Stephen Wolfe's Christian nationalism is the answer. Christian friends. And that indicates something about conservatives as a movement. The right, conservatives, have never been one big thing where everybody agrees. I mean, we're Baptists, right? Baptists are controversial people. We're united on the major things, but on a lot of things where we don't agree on stuff. Same is true for conservatives. Conservative movement began in 1790 when Edmund Burke wrote his Reflections on the Revolution in France. And conservatives ever since have argued among themselves about what true conservatism is. Who is a true conservative? You hear people say, well, he's not a true conservative. Okay? It's like saying, are you a true Baptist? I mean, it's the same thing. In the Civil War can be described, and has been described by historians, as really a war over which conservatism would rule the day. Would it be Lincoln's conservatism? Lincoln wanted to conserve the tradition of the Union of States. And he wanted to go back to human dignity as defined in Genesis. That every man, woman, and child is created in the image of God. John C. Calhoun, representing the Southern way of life, they were conservative. They wanted to conserve, in the South, the old idea of state sovereignty and state rights. And they wanted to maintain an economy and a society that was predicated upon slavery, which is also a tradition. These two kinds of conservatism battled it out between 1861 and 1865. All this shows us is that conservatism is not just one big thing where everybody agrees. You and I disagree. We will disagree on a lot of things. So what are our options as conservatives, giving due consideration to the fact that we all have differing views on how to deal with the challenges of our day? Do we give up on conservatism, for example? Do we say like Stephen Wolfe, well, I'm not a conservative? Or do we think all conservatives are the same? They're all just a bunch of rubes, a bunch of rednecks. Do we embrace post-liberalism and throw out the Constitution? Do we just sort of escape? Do we escape into the past? I mean, a lot of people love history and are history buffs because it's an escape for them. They don't have to think about the problems of the present because they can look back to World War II or the Civil War, or they can look back to the Renaissance, the Reformation. They just kind of get lost in the nostalgia of the past. Do we become apolitical? We're just not going to be involved in politics. Just withdraw from all of it. Stop reading the paper and just, I don't want to hear it. I just put a bag over my head and tell the world, you can't see me. we recover Burkean traditionalist conservatism, which is the predominant conservative tradition in America. And I want to introduce you, as I've said, I was going to, I promised you that I would, I want to introduce you to a great conservative thinker, Peter Viereck. You may have heard of him, most people have not heard of him, but he's the person I want to introduce you to today. Peter Viereck lived during World War II, he was born in 1916, he died in 2006. He lived during World War II, he lived during the threat of communist expansion, he lived during the Red Scare, he lived during the years of the Cold War, he saw the radical liberation movements of the 60s, the expansion of the government in the Great Society. The challenges that he saw the world had, those challenges were existential, they were really real, and just like the ones we have today. And in many ways, we can learn from Viereck, whose world was topsy-turvy just like ours is. Ultimately, a traditionalist Burkean conservative understands that there is no such thing as a perfect society. See, that's Wolf's problem. Wolf's Christian nationalism wants to envisage a perfect society. You know who else envisaged a perfect society?
Marx.
We're conservatives. We know that a perfect society is impossible this side of the new heaven and new earth. Human nature is fallen. Human societies are constructed and managed by fallen human beings. Every societal model will be flawed. What's the goal then? The goal is to find the best societal model given human sin. And in American history, that model has been the constitutional order established in 1789 when the Constitution went into effect. Governments are instituted to secure citizens' rights to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Amen. For ourselves and for our posterity. So in the face of changes in society, changes in the world, citizens manage change procedurally, as they're informed by tradition, law, and eternal truth, revealed in Scripture, revealed in nature. Peter Viereck championed those ideals in his life. He was born in 1916, he died at 89 in 2006. He went to school, he went to college at Harvard, and he got his PhD at Harvard in 1941. And he went on to teach. He taught European history at Mount Holyoke College in New England, an all-girls school. He taught at that girls' school for 50 years. Can you imagine, I mean, as a man, being a professor at an all-girls school for 50 years? Wow, I mean, I live in a household full of girls. It ain't easy, okay? It ain't easy. So he did it for 50 years. He taught 50 years. He taught until 1997. He was a history professor, but you know what's interesting about him? He won a Pulitzer Prize for poetry in 1949. Here are just a couple of his books. If you like poetry and you want to read his collection of poems that won a Pulitzer Prize, is the one on the far left, Terror and Decorum. In 1949, he wrote Conservatism Revisited. In 1956, he wrote Conservatism from John Adams to Churchill. And in that same year, 1956, he wrote The Unadjusted Man in an Age of Overadjustment. Now you can get all these books on Amazon. They're out of print, but they've been reprinted by a third party, and you can buy all of these books for between reasonable prices on Amazon. And I recommend, if you want to pick one book that he wrote that you want to read, I would say pick like The the entry into Furyk's writings is the third one, Conservatism from John Adams and Churchill. If you're going to pick one, I would say pick that one. He wrote other works of intellectual history. He wrote 13 published collections of poems. Furyk was a very strange man, like a lot of professors are. You know, did you have professors in college or teachers in high school? They were weird, quirky. Furyk was a quirky guy. I had my freshman advisor when I went to college was I had been a student of Peter Furyk's. She went to Mount Holyoke in the 60s, and she told me these great stories about what he was like as a prof. So one of the things he used to do, he would be on campus and he would climb a tree and sit up in the tree while students were walking to and from their classes. He'd be up in the tree. There's Dr. Furyk up in the tree. He would never start class on time. He was always late. He'd come to class 15 minutes late, and he would begin class, and when he would lecture, he never looked at the students when they were sitting. He stared at the light fixtures when he would lecture. Never looked at anybody in the eye. He never gave any feedback on any assignments. And he never told you what grade you made on any of his tests. You found out what your grade was at the very end of class when you got your report card. He also was someone who would be lost in thought. As he was walking around, he would run into things, he would run into the wall. His wife set up a mattress in their stairwell, because he would be walking down the stairs and he would be so lost in thought that he would run into the wall. So she put a mattress up so that it would soften the blow. When he got to Mount Holyoke, he forgot to ask for an office. So he'd never had an office on campus for 50 years. A student invited him one time to a Sunday dinner. And he was an hour late because he forgot to change his watch to daylight savings time. 2 weeks after daylight savings time. So he was a strange bird. You know, for 50 years, he was loved. He was a beloved professor. Our campus students adored him. And he loved them too. This is an example of what a conservative does. A conservative plants himself and dedicates himself or herself to the service of a particular people for a long, long time. And I love that about Peter Furyk. Peter Furyk had a definition of conservatism, but here it is. And I'm just going to read this to you. And I think it's a beautiful, beautiful definition. The conservative principles, par excellence, are proportion and measure. Self-expression through self-restraint. Preservation through reform. Humanism and classical balance. A fruitful nostalgia for the permanent beneath the flux. And a fruitful obsession for unbroken historical continuity. These principles together create liberty. Liberty built not on the quicksand of adolescent defiance, but on the bedrock of ethics and law. I can't add anything to that. It's just a beautiful articulation of what conservatism is. Just quickly give you some features of Furyk's thought. On change. Change, nobody likes change. It's human nature not to like change. My daughters are getting older, they're 21 and 17. In a short time, they're gonna leave home and they're not gonna be around anymore. That's a big change. It's good. I don't want them to live in my basement. I want them to get married and have families of their own. But I also really like my kids. I'm going to miss them when they're gone. I don't like that kind of change. I'm reputation from liberals that we don't like change. We think change is inherently bad. Progressives think change is good. They think it's inherently good. Remember Barack Obama's campaign? Change. Change for the sake of change. And again, you're not the youngest group in the world. Do you remember the 1992 campaign? Bill Clinton, George Bush, Ross Perot. Do you remember, I think it was the third debate. Did y'all watch those debates in 1992? I did. I remember Clinton did something really powerful in that debate. He turned and he looked at George Bush on the platform. He looked directly at him and he said, "For 12 years, you've had it your way. It is time for a change." You remember that? Change for the sake of change, because change is inherently good. That's what progressives think. Conservatives are supposed to say change is bad. That's not really true. Change is inevitable. And change can be very bad if it is not managed. Managed by procedure, by just law, by tradition, by morality. And if change is too fast, conservatives prefer slow change. Conservatives also, as according to Viereck, we don't like ideologies. We don't like abstract ideas. We like concrete examples. We like tangible. We like the real. And tradition is valuable to us because in tradition, in the past, we see that our forebears struggling with problems in the world having to do with sin. And they sometimes succeeded and sometimes they failed. And we learn lessons from the past that we can take and apply those lessons to our own day. That's concrete. That's real. You don't have to reinvent the wheel with some theory to deal with problems in the world today. You can look back to history and see what people in the past did, and you can take their lessons and apply them to today. That's what conservatives do. So Viereck has this great, great quote. It's awesome, and it captures this difference between liberals, progressives, who want to say theories are the answer, as opposed to conservatives who look to concrete experience. He says this: liberalism argues. Conservatism simply is. And I think that's brilliant. Now, after the fall of Napoleon in 1815, there emerged rival views of conservatism for the first time. Evolutionary, Burkean, traditionalist conservatives, and Hottentot, authoritarian conservatives. Now, today, here are some examples of traditionalist, good traditionalist conservatives. I'm just going to give you three examples of people today. And you can look these people up, and you can read their articles and their books, and look at their YouTube videos, and you can see what a good traditionalist conservative looks like. Robert George, political theorist, probably the most prolific conservative writer today is Robert P. George. And then in the center is Delano Squires. And Delano Squires is a scholar at the Heritage Foundation. He writes on the family. Solid Christian guy. And then on the far right is Carl Truman. Carl Truman is a Presbyterian. He teaches history and church history at Grove City College. And he's written some really, really good books recently. These are three very good living conservatives today, and I recommend you to them. They're also good friends of mine. In the past, there were some traditionalist conservatives in the past. Abraham Lincoln was a traditionalist conservative. Winston Churchill, great conservative thinker and a great conservative man. which was one of the really popular books people read and informed the Patriot cause. But he also wrote a book a little bit later on called The Age of Reason, which is a terribly anti-Christian book. It just attacks Christianity, attacks the church, attacks Christian theology. And Thomas Paine, according to Peter Viereck, is the father of the American left. I think he's right. On the left, these figures on the left believed in the natural goodness of human beings. And they denied that human beings were sinners. They also believed in the inherent rightness of the masses. So if the masses, if the majority takes a particular position in society, the majority must be right. So back to Rousseau, man is born free and everywhere in chains. The chains are tradition, religion, history, just law. And Viereck said, in response to that, as I said last night, in chains, and so he ought to be. Because we are sinners, and we need to be restrained against our unruly, disordered passions. But Rousseau wanted the chains to be eradicated by the masses. And Marx and Hegel would be deeply informed by Rousseau. Rousseau was the greatest influence also on Maximilien Robespierre, who murdered Louis XVI and tens of thousands of people during the Reign of Terror at the guillotine in 1793. With regard to tradition for Viereck is the most effective way to restrain human sin. Viereck said, it's trust in unbroken historical continuity and in some traditional framework to tame human nature. That's what's necessary to restrain human nature. The law is tradition in code, and it guards against tyranny, and it guards against anarchy. Tradition is an inheritance given to us by our ancestors, who tested and tried the principles by hard experience. Tradition is a social, cultural cement holding together what Western man has built. And that gets us to religious freedom. The tradition of religious freedom has endured and expanded in America from Roger Williams in the 17th century to today. And Americans have maintained the tradition, that particular tradition, because they've historically understood that if you're going to have freedom, need religion, especially Christianity. So I am arguing here today, conservatives are in the best position to maintain the tradition of religious liberty in America. And I want to just return back to Tocqueville. I've referenced Tocqueville a lot in the last couple of days, last night, today. Tocqueville was a visitor to America in 1831. He wasn't all that religious himself. He was sort of a nominal Catholic. He had a priest for a tutor. By the time he was 16, he was convinced that philosophy was superior to faith and to theology. But even having said all that, he still believed that religion, especially Christianity, was necessary to liberty. In fact, in Democracy in America, he contrasts Christianity with Islam to show that Islam cannot secure liberty, only Christianity can. Now, Tocqueville was convinced by his experience in France and under the revolutions, and by his observations of Americans about the necessity of religion to liberty. He said that the spirit of liberty and the spirit of religion were in harmony. He said that they were intimately joined. They reigned together over the same soil. And while in America, when Tocqueville came, it was in the middle of the Second Great Awakening, he said he saw a ton of different denominations and different churches. Every religious group, churches, different organizational structures, different denominations, but they all agree on morality. This is what he said. Each sect worships God in its own way, but all sects preach the same morality in the name of God. I really like that. So because of the fundamental moral agreement among Christians of all the various denominations, according to Tocqueville, there could be no other place in the world other than America in which Christianity dominates society so thoroughly. And because of that fact, there could be no other place in the world than in America where there is found more freedom. So the fact that Americans were so religious meant that liberty was in its purest form than anywhere else in the world. And he saw those two things as being completely connected. Tocqueville wrote extensively about how democracy tends towards tyranny, not liberty. Democracy tends towards tyranny because the essential quality of democracy is what he called equality of conditions. And that's different than what is articulated in the Declaration of Independence. The Declaration of Independence, all men are created equal, equality before God, equality of rights, and equality before the law. But when Tocqueville came, he saw there was more to equality than just that. He said there was equality of conditions. Equality of conditions. And basically this meant for Tocqueville that you could be born poor and rise to great wealth. Didn't matter who your father was. You also could be born to great wealth and squander it away. So there is there's great movement up and down the socioeconomic ladder. And so the quality of conditions, this leveling effect that it has, leads to materialism. It leads to selfishness. It leads to isolation. Because human nature is sinful. And when citizens stop caring about the public good and spend all their time pursuing their private interests, they look to the government to solve all their problems. Does this sound familiar? The government is always happy to oblige, because when the government gets to step in and solve problems, it gets more power. And soon the power of the government becomes irresistible. The self-centered citizens find nothing to complain about as long as they get to keep and enjoy their creature comforts. It's part of the reason why Tocqueville said that Americans would more quickly give up their freedom than their equality. Because equality yields smaller and insignificant blessings, but equality yields immediate gratification. Freedom's benefits are dearly bought and paid for and come slowly. So tyranny is more often the product of a democracy because of the political, social, and economic leveling effects. But here's the hope that Tocqueville had. Religion, Christianity, lessens these deleterious effects. Because what does Christianity do? Christianity turns your attention away from the cares of this world to the world to which you are going. Christianity also points people to a communal life, the church, the life of the church. So, life is bigger than just my Wi-Fi isn't working. Christianity teaches people to pursue their private interests morally. He said, religion will not succeed in turning men away from their love of riches, but they can still persuade them to enrich themselves by honest means. So people get rich in America. But people who get rich honestly. They don't steal their wealth. Because religion teaches them not to do that. And then also religion forms the basis for voluntary associations. Voluntary associations there's a million other things. You could join the NRA. You could join the Lions Club. churches fall into this category, although churches are much more than just that. They are that. What do voluntary associations do? They get people out of their houses. And they get people mixing up with other people that maybe they don't know very well. And they get to work with other people for the sake of a common cause. And those other people might not have the same background as you do. You might work with people that are richer than you. You might work with people that are of a different race than you. You might work with people that, you know, maybe don't agree with you on every political issue. But you work together for one common cause. Like, if you join the NRA, what is the NRA dedicated to? Championing the Second Amendment. In the NRA, you might have people that are not Christians. Shoot, there might be Democrats in the NRA. But you don't care about all that. What you care about is the Second Amendment, and that's why you're together. And you get out and you meet people of different backgrounds than you, and you work towards a common goal. So, in a religious society, people get out of their houses, they go to church, they serve the poor, they fellowship with their neighbors. They see that when the society flourishes, they flourish. And if the society goes down the tubes, then so am I. Religion is the most powerful political force in America. That's what Tocqueville said. And the great irony in all this is that there is no established church. No established church, no state church. It's just incomprehensible to him. In France, I mean, the Catholic Church had been in charge for centuries. He couldn't conceive of a society without an established church. And yet in America, there's no established church. And religion flourishes like in nowhere else in the world. Religion also informed the mores, as I said yesterday, which influences the laws, which then in turn regulates the state. He thought that one of his most important observations was that the mores of the people did more to secure liberty than any other single dynamic. This is what he said about that. So seriously do I insist upon this? If I have hitherto failed in making the reader feel the important influence of the practical experience, the habits, the customs of the Americans upon the maintenance of their institutions, I have failed in the principal object of my work. Religion informed the mores that undergirded the political, social, and commercial life of the Republic through marriage, through the family, which were indispensable to the success of public life. Indispensable. So, an example of this, a politician or a businessman was dishonest, unfaithful. They couldn't be successful in public or in private. In other words, if a politician was found to be unfaithful to his wife, or if a businessman was found to be a cheater in the home, word would get out, and that dishonest person would be ruined at home and in public. Virtue is learned best through the fulfillment of duties towards others. And where do you get practice more than anywhere else in serving others? In the home. Anybody who's married knows that marriage is work, and anybody who's a parent knows that self-sacrifice is essential to being a good mother. And so you get practice in these things. You get practice in virtue, first and foremost, in the home. And in balancing private and public interests, you learn these things first in the home. Now, that America that Tocqueville saw, the America before the Civil War, is different than our own. It was defined by a broad cultural agreement on Protestant religion, Protestant morality. And if America, I said this yesterday, if America was ever a Christian nation, it was between 1776 and 1861. And that's due to the widespread reach of the revivals of the Second Great Awakening, the growth of the free church denominational traditions like the Methodists, the Baptists, Disciples of Christ. If America was ever a Christian nation, it was then. But that Protestant consensus began to break down as a result of the Civil War, and then continued to deteriorate for the next century. The trauma of the Civil War, social, economic, the demographic changes that came with immigration in the 1890s and the 1920s, the spread of the Industrial Revolution, Western expansion, the acquiring of overseas colonies during the Spanish-American War, the World Wars, the Depression, the fundamentalist and modernist controversies of the 20th, the technological revolution, social upheavals of the 60s, all these things slowly whittle away the Protestant dominance in American culture. Today, American mores are influenced by celebrities, 24-hour news coverage, Facebook, social media, movies, entertainment, a host of non-religious sources which are often hostile to Christianity. The world of Tocqueville's America is long gone. We are facing a moral crisis in our country, the likes of which we've not seen since the days leading up to the Civil War. The Civil War is often described as a theological crisis, because at its heart was an argument over how to interpret and apply the Bible to the principal moral issue of the day, which was slavery. We also face a theological crisis because we're challenged to interpret and apply the Bible to the sanctity of marriage, the dignity of human life, the freedom of the individual conscience before God in a society that descends deeper and deeper. Christianity continues to be the moral and political basis for freedom in America. That's one thing that has not changed. Tocqueville saw that truth almost 200 years ago. It was a truth that he went back to France and tried to convince his countrymen there about. Nobody believed him. He was a voice in the wilderness. Whether we heed Tocqueville's warnings and encouragements and wisdom and lessons concerning how to guard liberty from democracy's tendency towards tyranny, that remains an open question. But conservatives are in the best position to maintain the tradition of religious liberty in America better than anybody else, because we revere tradition, and we revere America. So may we steward our privilege and our responsibility faithfully for the sake